Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 59 of NML Crossing, where we're kind of up against the clock. The day sort of got away from me here. We're still in, you know, it's like this move will just never end. It's every day, every single day. It's like digging into a wound. It's not ideal, but oh boy, I hope it's almost over soon. I was going to say it's almost over, but I don't want to jinx it. And boy, it's been a lot of doing. And right now, I'm able to squeeze this recording in while I have potatoes baking. So I think that's kind of my time limit. I've got a timer going for the potatoes. So this will be the potato episode, I guess, where we are starting an all-new arc here. It's another two-parter, and we're going to be looking at an issue of the flagship. This is Batman 565, which had a May 1999 cover date. We're really burning through 1999 here. We're just about halfway through it. I wasn't expecting that to go quite this fast. The story is Mosaic, Part 1, written by Greg Rucka with art by Frank Terran. Colors, Gloria Vasquez in Wildstorm Studios. Letters, John Costanza. Edits, Illidge, Vincenzo O'Neill, cover price $1.99. And this is an issue that has a cover that I absolutely hate. I feel like I see this one everywhere. You got Black Mask, he's not, his face is all scarified, he kind of looks like a crispy critter. It's not a very nice looking cover. Talent-wise and craft-wise, it's really good, but I just don't like looking at it. I think we all have books that we see the cover and we're just like, ugh, this is one of those for me. I feel like it was just always on the top of the pile. So I'm happy that we're going to get through it and I get to file it away forever. Now let's kick it off here. We open with a shot of a broken mirror and a bowl of ashy, sooty, real dirty water. And we also see the shattered reflection of our, I guess he'll be our level 3 boss, Black Mask. He's pontificating to his followers about how everything has changed and how now it's time to drop all disguises, no more masks. It's time to show their true faces, which are also the true faces of the new look Gotham City. And he vows to purge all of those who cannot see his truths. And his followers seemingly number in the hundreds. I mean, we're in this huge room, like a warehouse, it seems here. Or maybe it's an alley, I don't know. But there's just like an endless congregation of scarified former false facers here, all falling in line. From here, we zip over to the clock tower, where Barbara Gordon has, well, if we were reading Miracle Man, it would be a dream of flying. But she's more a dream of swinging through the skies of Gotham City as Batgirl. She wakes up and she thinks about how she's had this same Batgirl dream every time she's slept since the quake. Huh. Could she be our all-new, all-different Batgirl? No. Now, as she shakes the slumber out of her eyes, she gets a call from one of her agents. This is a fella by the name of Rex. He reports in that his sector is quiet. However, there's a little bit of a hubbub going on at the Wayne Omnitech building. He asks if he ought to maybe pop in and check it out, and Babs gives him the verbal thumbs up. Rex and Oracle disconnect their call, and we follow our guy toward the building. We also see that Batgirl is looking on, so for Babs to be Batgirl, she'd probably have to either have Mother Box technology or be able to tap into the Speed Force, so there's another point in the favor of her not being the new Batgirl, and we'll get confirmation at the end of the issue all the same here. Now, Rex, as he heads toward Omnitech here, he finds himself surrounded by Black Mask's followers, and then he is dragged inside Omnitech against his will. Batgirl swoops in to start cracking skulls, but she is just a moment too late to save old Rex. Next, we shift scenes over to Batman, who's having himself a meeting with the character Lockup, who I actually had to look up. Seems he's a fella with a prison fetish. He basically catches people and as his name might suggest, he locks them up. Now, it would appear that Batman is using this to his advantage, and I think we're just about to get our answer as to where the baddies wind up after Batman beats them up. Now, Lockup, he's acting as his no man's land warden. After Batman pulls his vanishing act, we can see that Lockup is also working alongside the KG Beast in this endeavor. Let's zip over to the GCPD, where Bullock is giving Gordon a bit of a sit-rep. Their perimeter's holding, so the Blue Boys are able to maintain all their territory. Foley is still being a dick. Well, a dick about Gordon's priorities, I suppose, but mostly just being a rational human being who doesn't want to be, I don't know, who doesn't want to die as a pawn for the commish. Also, Bullock reports that they spotted three new bat tags, which Jim orders to be painted over right away. Sarah tries to bring Jim back to reality by mentioning how, should they stay fixated on painting over bats, they might just wind up running out of paint. And I think we talked about that in the mailbag not too long ago. Gordon, he's not seeing any reason, and he remains steadfast. Though at this point he says he doesn't care if they're painted over. They could be scraped off. They could be burned for all he cares, just as long as they are gone. To which Sarah asks when he's going to stop being such a petulant brat. And to this, Jim actually balls up his little old man fists and bares his shockingly vampiric teeth. The art here, while fitting for the tone of the story, is quite ugly. Now, Gordon literally looks like Nosferatu with a bad toupee here. It's not pleasant to look at. Now, he pretty much dares Sarah to say the B word. And so she does. She says, Batman, 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 which ain't gonna go over well. From here, we hop back to the clock tower, where Babs is sitting safely away from all the nastiness below. She talks about how, while she's completely safe where she's at, she can't help but to also feel trapped. She also mentions how all of her agents have checked in for the day, except Rex. Outside, again, the art here is a little hard to follow, but I think it's a bunch of children pretending to be no man's land gang lords, while under the protection of some armed and armored Blue Boys. One of the kids asks an officer to fire off her flare gun, and she says, maybe later. And yes, this is Chekhov's flare gun. We hop over to Bat HQ. I'm not sure if we're in the sewer or at Arkham. I'm not sure it matters either. Where Batman tells Batgirl to take a rest. But she can't. She's frustrated that she was too slow to save Rex. To which Batman tells her to get good. Or rather, be faster. She asks him where he's been. And he tells her he was taking out the trash. She kinda gets his drift here and asks what he does with all the baddies he catches. You know, where do they go? He replies that she doesn't want to know. Batgirl reveals that Black Mask has taken two more Wayne buildings the night before. She says Mask is far scarier now and seems to be running a cult. And given the trajectory of his spread, it would appear as though he's going to try and take control of Old Gotham, which would pit his crew up against the Blue Boys. And well, as we know, the main Wayne building in Old Gotham just happens to be Oracle's clock tower, so it looks like business might be just about to pick up. Batman puts Batgirl in charge of this likely threat, claiming that he has business elsewhere. Okay. Now, she's not confident that she'll be able to do all of this. Batman says if she can't, then all she'll do is prove that she's not worthy of the mantle. Let's hop back over to the Blue Boys as they strut through Old Gotham. Foley and Bullock are chatting up some of the station patrolmen while Jim heads toward Barbara's place. Foley comments about Gordon's bad vibes and problematic priorities, and even jokes that it looks like there might be trouble brewing in his marriage. Bullock does not like what he hears, and so he threatens the only free thinker left in the GCPD. We rejoin Gordon as he's chatting up Babs, and he talks about his recent argument with Sarah. To which, she kinda sides with her, because Jim is being a bit of a brat. At best, he's being unreasonable, right? They then talk about Batman being back. And despite having seen him in action during the Father Chris ordeal, Gordon refuses to believe it. Batman abandoned them, and that's all there is to say about it. He says that Batman's return is just a rumor. Babs kind of plays dumb, and wonders if even that would be a bad thing, you know, because rumors of Batman's return would at least possibly inspire some hope. To which Jim says hope isn't what they need right now. They only need each other, and that's all they can really count on. From here, we head over to Black Mask's base of operations for our outro. He's got Rex hung upside down while he's heating up a hot poker in a bin fire. He interrogates Rex about how and where he'd gotten his supplies. You know, digging around in his bag, he finds a flashlight, knife, granola bar. And all of those things have to come from somewhere, right? Rex tells Black Mask to pound sand. And so, he gets the hot poker right in his eyes. At least I think it went right into his eyes. We don't actually see it happen, but we definitely see the word balloons of screaming. Rex, to his credit, and despite the torture, refuses to spill any beans. Later, the False Facers march into Old Gotham toward the clock tower, and they toss Rex's body. He's still alive, but they toss his body at the police. Barbara sees this happen and immediately arms herself with a sniper rifle. The officer from before reaches for her flare gun to call in reinforcements, but winds up getting shot by Black Mask before she can. She does ultimately fire it. Black Mask then claims the clock tower as the newest part of his territory. While he pontificates a bit, Babs takes aim and has Roman in her sights. She doesn't want to fire and really struggles quite a bit with even, you know, getting the ugly mug in her crosshairs. She proceeds to give herself a countdown before pulling the trigger, but before she can, Batgirl arrives, which, it would seem, is a sight Barbara was not ready for. That's where we leave it. Next time out, we wrap up Mosaic in Detective Comics number 732. Now, before we talk about the issue, we actually do have a letters page. This is a return to the letters pages here, and it's talking about a rather old issue. Let's see, we're in issue 565 of Batman, and this is about 559, so 6 months ago. If you don't remember, this is the Aftershock issue with the hospital, where Batman and Robin help secure a hospital because a gang is trying to steal the meds or whatever. Harvey Bullock has this odd, you know, whirlwind romance with a nurse for 5 seconds. It was a fun issue. So let's get into the letters here. We're going to start with Sarah in Los Angeles, who enjoyed the Vesper Fairchild narration for the issue, especially when juxtaposed with the bridge collapse. Now, this issue, I mean, we're going way back here. This ended with people trying to leave Gotham, but it overwhelmed one of the bridges out and it collapsed. And that scene was very powerful because of the attention it didn't get. You know, Vesper's narration pretty much told the story throughout, except right there. You know, it was very, very subtle, very nuanced, the juxtaposition was just off, and it was off on purpose, of course, and it worked quite well. Sarah continues to say she liked seeing Harvey attempt to start a relationship with a nurse What's-Her-Face. And yeah, I will agree, that was a very cute bit in the issue there, where what did he say here? His very suave verbiage was something along the lines of, like, I'm really into movies. Are you into movies? Just pretty funny stuff. I really dug it. Next up, we got another Sarah. This one's in Washington, D.C. And she wonders about some of the things Vesper said on the air, focusing on the supposition that the quake hit Gotham as punishment for their sin of pride. And I think, well, our editor is going to say it exactly how I was going to say it. So when we get to the reply that the editor has, if there's anything I need to add, I will, I'll do it there. Sarah saw 3 bright spots in this issue. The first one being Bullock and Nurse What's-Her-Face hitting it off. The second is Rene Montoya possibly inspiring that one doctor to remain in Gotham City even though his wife wanted to leave. I'm not sure I would put that in the bright spots of the issue. I mean, she might have just broken up a marriage there. She might have risked this dude's life. I don't know. Also, the third bright spot was Batman and Robin swooping in to help out. Now, she questions Batman not thinking Dick Grayson would be a suitable replacement for him should the need ever arise. She says that Tim has kept secrets from Batman in the past and has just plain gone against his wishes before, and cites two examples here, teaming with the Huntress during his third miniseries and teaming with Catwoman during Contagion. And the I recently read the Catwoman-Robin team-up in Contagion, and in it, I think they went up to Canada. Wherever they went, it was snowy. And Catwoman changed her costume into, like, this white version, and it looked ridiculous. It looked so bad, and she does, like, this, like, really, like, over-dramatized, like, striking a pose in it, like, which I think was supposed to be, like, really, like, drool-inducing hot for Robin. And he does, like, he does give, like, the whoa, you know, but it just looks so goofy. So goofy. Back to our letter writer here. Back to Sarah. Now, Sarah is worried that Bruce choosing Tim over Dick might lead to some acrimony between the two. Now, our editor responds to the Vesper line by saying it might have just been her way to try and make sense of things. Random tragedies are always a difficult pill to swallow since there often isn't anyone or anything to blame. You know, they're hard to find reason for. Many of us have lived through huge world-changing events that are, you know, I don't want to be specific with things, but a lot of things just are what they are. But our brains don't let us think that way. We don't want to think that anything can happen to anybody at any time. We have to, like, concoct these plans. We have to concoct reason. So a quake hitting Gotham City, that's a scary thing because it comes out of nowhere. That's not something you can prepare for or, you know, actively prepare for. Of course, you can retrofit buildings, but a quake's still going to do what a quake's going to do. So it's easier for people to digest when there is a boogeyman, like the sin of pride, you know, oh, this was our punishment. Maybe we were too proud. Maybe this is whatever deity, whatever higher power putting us in our place. It just makes it an easier pill to swallow for some people. And, you know, we've had world-changing events that just were what they were. But we always try to make more of it to kind of wrap around us like a blanket. You know, it's comforting to think that everything is for a reason rather than things being random and terrible sometimes. Now the editor continues. I don't know which editor this is. I know we had an editor who introduced themselves to us a few issues ago. Maybe this is that one. I don't know, but whoever it is, they ain't worried about there being any bones of contention between Nightwing and Robin. And he cites the events of Nightwing number 6 as evidence that all's good in the hood. And I read that issue probably a few months ago. Within the past few months, I was on a Nightwing kick and I was starting to go through the old Dixon stuff. After pulling myself through the Denny O'Neil stuff. I don't really remember much about the issue other than Tim went to Bloodhaven, Bluthaven. Our final letter comes from Rob with 2 B's in Ohio. And he was disappointed in this issue. He says it wasn't bad, just predictable. Though he does give the issue points for Robin appearing and helping out. So I guess you can't win them all, can you? So those were our letters. How about we talk about the issue here? And I think I have 3 big takeaways here. Commissioner Gordon being a real piece of work here. And it's only going to get worse as we move on to the second part of Mosaic. Gordon versus Sarah. This is not a good look for the commish. Where he's like, it's like the you know, bang zoom to the moon almost. It's almost a Ralph Cramden thing, where he's daring her to make him mad. He's daring her to say trigger words or trigger phrases to set him off, and she does, because she ain't screwing around. She wants to shock Jim back to reality one way or another, and so she actually says the word he doesn't want anyone to say. She says Batman. And his response to that, whether it be instinct, whether it be simple reflex, or whether it be actual threat, he balls up his fists. And he, like, gets in her face. It's not a great look for the commish here. And you gotta wonder, I mean, this base of operations that the Blue Boys are operating out of doesn't look like a terribly huge place. You know, stands to reason that if he's shouting at his wife and making threats, that this is being overheard. And we're going to get verification next time out that it is being overheard and people are concerned. You got to wonder if that's going to weigh on anybody's mind when trying to decide whether or not they're going to follow this man's lead. You know, he's becoming irrational and violent, or potentially violent. He hasn't become violent to this point, but he's in the arena. He's definitely in the ballpark, and that is and I gotta say, the writing here is fantastic here. This argument feels real, like uncomfortably real. Like if you've ever been in the room with a couple who are in the middle of some sort of crisis, or maybe on their way out of being a couple, this one might resonate. Me and the wife recently rewatched Cheers, and in those early seasons, when you'd have like those in your face arguments between Sam and Diane, those were like so uncomfortable but so well done. This gave me vibes of that. It was just really good writing. Not a good look for Gordon, but good writing. The next takeaway is Babs versus Batgirl. We've got Barbara Gordon dreaming of her time as Batgirl at the beginning of the issue, and then the issue ends with her seeing her replacement. And that's because there hasn't been a Batgirl since Barbara at this point. It's weird to think about that nowadays, where, I mean, what are there, like 8 or 9 Batgirls right now and like 17 Batmen? You know, this is a different time. This is when mantles were sacred. So we had our Batgirl. I mean, we had Golden Age stuff, but in the modern age, we had Barbara Gordon. And now we have this new Batgirl just swooping in, stealing her mantle, stealing her identity in a way. It's, I like how this is playing out. This is very, very interesting. The third takeaway would be Batman's jail. We were questioning where these villains went to, where the bad guys go to. And, you know, I think in the first arc, Batman said they go to hell. And here, you know, Batman just says, you don't want to know. You don't want to know where they go. And now we do know where they go. They're under the watchful eye of Lockup and KG Beast. Since it's KG Beast and we last saw him during that Blackgate Isle of Men one-shot, perhaps we can assume that Batman's jail is Blackgate. And we're going to see more of the jail in subsequent episodes, of course, but I don't know. I couldn't say with 100% certainty that it is Blackgate just yet. But wherever it is, I like that it exists. If it is Blackgate, that'd be pretty cool because we have Batman operating out of Arkham and using Blackgate as his prison. That's pretty interesting stuff here. I really, really like that. One thing about Batman that I am questioning after this issue, you know, I've said it many times over the past several episodes, Batman's been trying to reestablish himself, right? He wants to be seen in front of people. He wants people to see him do his thing so he can re-inspire fear, re-inspire respect, just really drive home that he is still the law here. He is still the protector of this city, regardless of whether or not it's still part of the United States, right? And here, he sends Batgirl in to deal with Black Mask, saying he has to go somewhere else. It's like, yeah, I got other stuff to do. You take care of this for me. Seems weird. Seems weird. You'd figure Batman would want to be everywhere all at once, right? I guess not. I guess not. Maybe this is a test. Who knows? I feel like it was a little bit, I don't want to say out of character, but I don't know. It just doesn't line up with the other stories that we've had so far. But, you know, as we've talked about over the course of the past several story arcs here, Batman isn't the star of any of them, right? And I guess this kind of plays into that. Batman is there. He does loom over everything. But this is a Gordon family story and a Batgirl story. So Batman is kind of just, he's just in the background. I wonder how long it'll be before we get like a straight up Batman story in No Man's Land. Maybe we don't. It's been so long since I read it. I can't say one way or another. But I'm liking what we're reading so far. I'm having a really good time with it. I hope you are as well. This is yet another really good issue in our post No Man's Land landscape. But I think that's where we will end the discussion for this issue, and we will hop into our NML bag before we cut out. We're going to start with a letter from our good friend Billy D, who says, "Hey Chris, congrats on the congrats on the monumental 1,000th episode. Huge accomplishment, and I know how much you put into podcasting, so it means more than the average bear. Looking forward to hearing more episodes in the future. Thanks for doing what you do." And I want to thank Billy, and I want to thank everybody who had kind words to say about the big 1,000. I used to keep track of that kind of stuff, like numbers, like what number blog post is this? And I would put like the number at the bottom of my blog post in like ramping up to milestone episodes or blog posts, I guess. And I totally lost track of the Podbean account. I didn't know how many episodes there were. It's been a long time since I got one of those. Congratulations, you hit a milestone. So seeing this one in the email box was just, you could have knocked me over with a feather. It's like, that's 1,000 episodes. And, I mean, that and $5 will get me a cup of coffee, but, it's still pretty cool. It's still pretty cool to have that. And I don't want to veer into my trademark preciosity, but, I love the fact that I could go back through these 1,000 episodes and hear voices of my friends who are still with us and who are no longer with us. It's part of like this weird, you know, Chris and Reggie tapestry still. It's like all these shows, all these friends. It's cool. It's really, really cool. So thank you to Billy, and thank you to everybody who reached out via, you know, social media or text and stuff. It really does mean a lot to me. I can't believe I have one episode up, much less, what is this, 1,002, 1,003 right now? It's insane to me. It really, really is. But thank you. Thank you so much. Next, we hop back into the Bat world here with our friend Chris Yu, who's talking about the first part of Bread and Circuses. He says, "I think that just like Gordon is trying to expand his territory, Batman is visiting different neighborhoods to make sure everyone in Gotham knows that he's back. Batman is seen battling the Red Devils, which is a gang that we've yet to see, so it looks like he's in a different territory than before." And yeah, we haven't seen the Red Devils, and I'm tempted to call them the Red Devils, because, when you spell words with Z's, it's a lot cooler. And that is a great point. You know, I kind of rode this one a bit for the repetitive nature of Batman reestablishing himself, while kind of missing the point that there's something he's going to have to do. You know, I don't remember which arc it was that started with the fact that, you know, there is no internet, there are no newspapers, there isn't radio, there isn't television. I think it was the Ventriloquist story, where, you know, you come to the realization that the people only know what they're told, right? So, sure, it would stand to reason that Batman would have to reestablish himself in every neighborhood. So, I might have spoken out of turn when I was kind of ragging on the stories for kind of being formulaic, but, and I mean, it doesn't mean that they weren't formulaic, but there's a purpose to the formula, right? Chris continues. He says, Penguin is acknowledging that Batman is back for the first time in public, so of course he would be downplaying his previous interactions with Batman that he really come up on the wrong end of. He needs to appear strong to the masses. That's another great point. I mean, Penguin is one of the biggest movers and shakers in No Man's Land. So, yeah, if he comes up on the short end of a quarrel or just a running up against Batman and coming out looking weak, he's not going to want to advertise that. That makes a lot of sense as well. I'm not sure if that's us no-prizing or if it's or if it was intentional, you know. I don't know if, I think it was Edginton who wrote that. I don't know if he knew that Batman and Ozzy had crossed paths. But it works. We can lampshade it, right? Chris continues. He says, up until now, very few of the residents of the No Man's Land know that Batman's back. So his desire to make big public appearance at the Penguin Shindig is the best way for him to get as many eyes on him as possible. Then have them spread the word so that the Bat is back and he means business. And yeah, I concede that point for sure. It does make a lot of sense, especially when we take into account that all of the gangs were kind of zeroing in on the Davenport building to see this play out. So once they do see it play out and then they disperse, that's a great way of making the word travel. So that definitely is a really good point and kind of one of those examples of me not being able to see the forest for the trees. It happens. It happens. It'll probably happen again. I transfix, you know, I get tunnel vision. So, yeah, this all makes perfect sense. It gives us that internal logic that the folks on Usenet were so so hungry for. But thank you so much for writing in, Chris, and pointing those things out. That's fantastic stuff. I really, really appreciate it. But that's going to do it for today's mailbag. Of course, if you'd like to be part of the mailbag, I encourage and invite you to write in or reach out or do whatever it is in order to get your words into my mouth. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, all the Facebooks and Twitters and all that kind of stuff as well. But I think that's going to do it for me for today, and I beat the clock here. The baked potato's still got 2 minutes and 39 seconds left, so we did it. I want to thank you all so much for joining me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. It comes to shove, we do not fall out of love.